I'm going to be reading from Hebrews chapter 13, verses 10 through 16. Hebrews chapter 13, 10 through 16. We have an altar that those who serve in the tabernacle have no right to eat from. For the body of those animals whose blood the high priest brings into the sanctuary as an offering for sin are burned outside the camp. Therefore, to sanctify the people by his own blood, Jesus also suffered outside the camp. We must go out to him, then outside the camp, bearing the abuse he experienced. For here we have no lasting city, but we seek the city that is to come. Through him, let us continually offer up a sacrifice of praise to God, that is the fruit of our lips, acknowledging his name. And do not neglect to do good and to share what you have, for God is pleased with such sacrifices.
Good morning. It's good to see everybody this morning. Well, this being my last time to be before you this weekend, I just want to say thank you again for allowing me to be a part of this. It certainly has been a blessing that we've been all be together this weekend. As Bob mentioned earlier, what a blessing it is when Christians can be together so much. And that's a concentrated effort that we've had this past weekend. It's just been a blessing for me and my family, and hopefully for you as well. I do want to also mention thank you to our host family, in our case, the Warfels, but certainly other host families this weekend that have kept these men and their wives and family, how much we are appreciative that they have sacrificed time, effort, and certainly money to do that, giving us food and board for the weekend, practicing first century hospitality, and we're just so thankful for that we can come into Christians' homes and feel so welcome among our brethren and get to know them certainly better. Thank the elders again for their foresight to be able to do this, their interest in you, that they love you and they see a need. That's part of leadership, is to see a need and to address that. And they've certainly done that this weekend. I appreciate them doing that as well. And thank you all for your interest in this, especially you parents who have been here over and over, many of you even not parents who have come to hear God's word and hopefully benefited from that. It certainly is encouraging that you have that desire. Been some late nights on Thursday and Friday, and then all day on Saturday, and these are the ones with little kids too, so it is often difficult for them, but they've made the sacrifice and they've shown their children how important it is to come together with God's people and learn God's word. But most of all, we thank God, who is the giver of all things and who has made us by adoption his children, as we have sang this morning, and has given us children as stewards for just a short time to give back to him. We give all praise and honor and glory to him. You know, if you want to know what water is, then do not ask a fish. And the reason is because a fish doesn't even know that it's wet. And in the same way, culture is for humans what water is to fish. That the environment in which we live in, we come to think as normal. The difference is, unlike fish in the water, is that humans create their own culture. But like fish that are immersed in water, we become so immersed in the ways of thinking and patterns of living that we become unable to recognize them. Many of you might like going visiting in the mountains, and you love the mountain views, how the sun comes up over them and how beautiful that is. But it's tempting for those who live in the mountains to take that for granted. They see this every day. They don't even come to recognize the beauty of it sometimes. Or maybe it's like people who are raised in a dysfunctional family. They may not even know that it's dysfunctional. They think that this is normal. And the battle that Christian parents face is that we and the children that we are trying to raise may be living lives influenced by our culture, and we may not even know it. We may not even recognize it. And that is especially becomes a problem for us parents, that we are trying to raise and grow godly children. But there's so many things in our culture that make it very difficult to be doing that. And although Satan did not create our culture, he uses it to pull our children away from us and ultimately away from God. And so we have to realize that the struggle that we are against, and as parents, we must discipline our children so that they are able to live in this culture and yet not be negatively influenced by it. And that's what we're going to be talking about this morning. But first, I need to begin by explaining some things about culture, things that probably you're aware of and maybe you're not. But I want us to just give an understanding of what we are talking about here this morning as we talk about culture. And let's just begin by defining culture. Because among Christians, it's a word that we use a lot. However, we hardly ever do define that. Well, what do we mean by that? Well, the word culture actually comes from a Latin word, cultura, which means agriculture, from which we get the word cultivate from. And so like a farmer that is in a field, culture is what we do with the world. It's an amoral term, which means that it's neither good nor bad in and of itself. Culture becomes good or bad based upon what society does with it in the world in which we live. And as a result, throughout the world and even throughout time, there are different cultures. In some cultures, people love their neighbors. In other cultures, they eat them. The difference between cultures is reflected in a society's worldview or their religion. And so religion changes culture like nothing else does. In the same culture, in the same land, culture may change because its religion, its worldview has changed. Cultural norms then are what we as society view as normal. And so in this country, we have a culture that drives cars. That's not the culture in other countries. And it wasn't the culture here even over 100 years ago. But it is out of the norm to ride a horse to work. But it's very normal to drive a car. In our culture, it's normal to retire in your 60s. It is normal to have babies in a hospital, though some people have been born, even in this room, outside the hospital, maybe in your home. That's not a norm, though. And so cultural norms are what we consider as normal in our culture today. We also need to know then what culture is not, because sometimes it helps us define a term by understanding what it doesn't include. So let me give you a few things here that culture is not. First of all, culture is not natural. It's not instinctive. God didn't create culture, but we create it by free will with the things that God has given us. Now, God does tell us how to create culture. He's done so in His Word, but unfortunately, most in the world have simply ignored that. Second of all, culture is not evil in and of itself. I think culture does refer sometimes to all the bad things, at least we think of it, all the bad things that humans do. For us Christians, I think that's how we think of culture, that we sometimes use the word culture as a synonym for bad music or alternative lifestyles, or liberal education, or addictive behavior, or immodest dress, or otherworldly things that we even talked about this morning. We sometimes say that the culture is destroying the church. Culture is destroying our kids, and I get that. And we need to protect our children from it. You know, the parents of the previous generation, my parents, tried to protect us from a culture that brought us Three's Company and Aerosmith, and Soviet Union and Bill Clinton. But the culture that day seems tame compared to the culture today that we are trying to protect our children from, that has given us TikTok and Taylor Swift and Hamas and radical Supreme Court decisions. Certainly, culture consists of bad things, but it is incomplete to think of culture as bad. Culture includes the good, the bad, and the morally neutral. Culture, again, is what society makes of it. And it just happens that right now, culture is made up of more evil than it is good. Thirdly, we have to understand that culture is not people. People make culture, but they're not the culture. And in turn, people are affected then by the culture. Our kids can be affected by culture, and that's why we are preaching on it this morning. But people are not culture, and culture is not people. And I think that's an important distinction to make,
Because if we think as people, as culture, and culture as the enemy, then we're likely to see people as the enemy. And our kids will get the idea that people around us are the enemy, but they are not. They are our neighbors that we must love. We must love the people and attack what they do and how they think. And that's how we have to teach our children as well. I think there's a big difference there. But then fourthly, as I already alluded to, culture changes. You know, it used to be a norm in our society for people to stay married for life. That's not the culture today. It used to be a culture that we would write letters by hand. Can you imagine that? Or, you know, it used to be the culture that we would answer the telephone before we knew who was calling. You remember that? You just have to answer. Oh, I wish I wouldn't have answered this phone. Instead of seeing them come up on caller ID. Or in my culture, when I grew up, you had to pick up the phone first to see if your neighbor was on there. And then I had to wait, and you keep picking that up. And then when you finally do make a call, you hope they're not listening in so you couldn't say anything private. That was my culture that I grew up in. And there was a culture, even before my time, of bell-bottom jeans. Thankfully, culture changes over time. But those things are no longer part of our culture. And when one generation, what they consider normal, the next generation considers odd, considers funny. And that's okay with some things, but not when it comes to moral issues. In years past, there was a time in our country when it was a lot easier, you have to admit, to have a deep Christian commitment. Back in the good old days, religion was an acceptable social outlet. It was accepted among our culture. Culture supported it. That everyone or most people held religious beliefs, and everyone in the neighborhood went to church on Sunday mornings. I remember in fourth grade, Mrs. Ware's class, we all sat in alphabetical order. So there was John Anderson, and then there was Jonathan Brown, and so forth, all the way back to Billy Zimmerman. And I remember Mrs. Ware on the first day of school, she said, I want everybody to stand up one at a time, starting in the front, going to the back, introduce yourself and tell what church you go to. And of course, we all knew each other anyway, but we all go through, and finally we get to Billy Zimmerman, and he stands up and says, I'm Billy Zimmerman, and I don't go to church. And everybody's, oh, what? Billy doesn't go to church. Billy doesn't go to church. But that was a shock. That was against the norm. We have to understand that. That back then, there were no ball games on Wednesday nights. Everyone went to Bible study, depending upon, you know, what religion you were going to. But even before my time, when it came time for a gospel meeting, hundreds of people were anxious for it. In fact, they'd been looking forward to it for months. And in those days, Christian moral standards were understood and appreciated. And all that made it relatively easy, you have to say, to hold on to your Christian beliefs. But that's not the way that it is today, is it? And today, we live in a culture where religion doesn't have much place in the public except for to be ridiculed. That our culture's values now run completely and totally contrary to the New Testament teachings. For example, the world today is obsessed with sexual things more than it ever has been before, at least in the United States. That sexual activities apart from marriage are considered acceptable and normal by more and more people. The concept of commitment, especially in the area of marriage, has almost completely disappeared. The idea of self-disciplined has been replaced by self-gratification. And things like honesty and integrity are just memories of a past generation. And I say all this to say that culture sometimes changes. Now, before I leave this point, let me leave it on a positive note, because this sounds all negative, doesn't it? And what that means is that culture can go back the other way as well, that not all is lost. Maybe we even start to see that shift happening, maybe just a little bit. I see little signs. But we and our children after us, we can change our culture by changing hearts around us individually, one at a time, through the gospel of Jesus Christ. Let me say another thing about cultures, and that is that to add to this confusion about understanding culture, we also have to understand that there are subcultures within a culture. And though there are some cultural norms that span across society, for example, almost everywhere in our culture, United States culture, we all have cell phones for the most part. There are some trends and some fashions that distinguishes some groups from other groups. You might say that there is a urban culture, a city culture, and there is a country culture. Country culture sometimes just wears camouflage around, for example. There is a homeschool culture. They smell like essential oils and they eat sourdough bread. That's how you know a homeschool culture. There are blue-collar culture. There's an east-west culture. There is a west coast culture. And there's a southern culture where I came from that likes NASCAR and their country music. In our country, it is accurate to speak of cultures in the plural, but there is a sense in which we're all affected by the overall culture of our country. One other thing I want you to understand, and here's probably the most important thing that I want you to understand about culture, and that is, what is it that controls our culture? And in one word, I would say that it is ideas. For example, it is a growing idea in our country that truth is not absolute, that it is a matter of opinion. According to a study in 2016 by the Barna Research Group, a majority of Americans, in fact, 57%, believed that knowing what is right or wrong is merely a matter of personal experience. 57%? Last year, in 2005, Arizona Christian University also put out a very similar poll, and they said 66% of our society does not believe in absolute truth. In other words, something is not right or wrong because God said it, but rather it's right or wrong because I think that it's wrong for me. It may not be wrong for you, but it's wrong for me. And what is right for me may not necessarily be right for you. We all individually get to choose what is right and wrong. And that view is even more prevalent among young adults. 3/4 of millennials, 74%, agree with this statement. And I quote, "Whatever is right for your life or works best for you is the only truth that you can know." 83% of 18-year-olds to 25-year-olds support the idea that moral truth depends completely on your circumstances. And I suspect that those percentages will grow even more in our children's generation. And we shouldn't be surprised, however, that people feel that way. Because the tendency of man is to want to get his own way and determine his own future. We have a tendency to be selfish. We want what we want, and we want it right now. And so people have a tendency to try to define truth in a way that's going to give them what they want. And so they come up with the idea that they have the right to determine right and wrong without submitting to any authority that is outside themselves. If I reject the notion that there is absolute truth, then you can't impose your beliefs upon me. You can't tell me what to do, and I can just do whatever I want to do. I am the source of truth, and I'll decide whether my actions are right and wrong based upon how I feel. And if it feels good, then it must be right, and I can do that. And who are you to tell me that I'm wrong to do that? And as long as it makes me happy, that's all that matters. As long as it doesn't hurt anyone else, it doesn't matter what I do. But what I want you to notice is that cultural idea is based upon a wrong idea. The truth is that truth matters. Jesus said so himself. In John chapter 8, he said in verse 31, "If you continue in my word, then you are truly disciples of mine, and you will know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." There is a truth, Jesus says, and it's important that what you believe is true, because what you believe determines how you behave. Behavior follows belief. It follows ideas. And what we teach our children to believe will determine how they live. What they believe to be true will determine how they treat other people. What they determine to be true will affect them, how they spend their money financially. It determines how they will behave morally, and ultimately it will determine how they live spiritually, which will determine what happens in the life to come. What you believe determines how you behave. Ideals and IDs, ideas rather, control culture. And we see this demonstrated in such a powerful way in the book of Judges. Remember at the end of the book of Judges, there's sort of these summary statements. In Judges chapter 17 and verse 6, it says, "In those days there was no king in Israel." Well, of course, we know that. There had not become a king. Saul had not come along yet. But more importantly, of course, what he's referring to is God was not their king. But notice the second part of that sentence, that every man did what was right in his own eyes. And by the way, this is also repeated at the very end of the book as well. Everyone's just doing what is right in their own eyes. So you got this whole nation of people doing what was right in their own eyes. And what did it result in? Well, look at the book of Judges. Chaos and tragedy. There's disobedience to the Lord. There's idolatry. There's immorality. There's things never go well when people do what is right in their own eyes. But I want you to notice how they got there. If you go back to the introduction of the book, it's interesting, chapter 2. In verse 7, it says, "The people served Yahweh all the days of Joshua, and all the days of the elders who survived Joshua, who had seen all the great works of Yahweh which he had done for Israel." There was a generation of Israelites under the leadership of Joshua, probably the greatest generation of Israelites, who did what was right. But they saw the things God had done for them, and they were following that. But there was a problem. That the next generation came along, it says in verse 10, there were also gathered, that generation, Joshua's generation, gathered to their fathers, and there arose another generation after them who did not know Yahweh, nor did they walk after which he had done for Israel. The sons of Israel did evil in the sight of Yahweh, and they served the Baals. Now, what that means is apparently the Israelites and their parents did not do what was commanded of them in Deuteronomy chapter 6. To teach their children as they walk by the way, as they lie down at night, as they rise up in the morning, to love the Lord their God with all their heart, soul, and strength. They were told to do that. And all it takes is one generation of parents not teaching their children to love God, for God's people to reach a point where they begin to live for themselves, and they turn their back on God, and they serve other idols. And so the book of Judges records a dark history of the consequences of a culture that is based upon the things of their own, not upon absolute truth. And you see the book of Judges, it starts out PG, and it ends up rated R. And unfortunately, people really haven't changed that much, have they, since the days of the Judges? People are still doing what is right in their own eyes. And when people do what is right in their own eyes, they will lie, they will cheat, they will covet, they will steal, they will hate, they will abuse, they will exploit if it gets them what they want. They will have sex with whomever they want to, whenever they want to. They will look at things they ought not to look at on the internet and do things they ought not to do. They will even murder their own unborn children in order to avoid an inconvenience. Everyone is doing what is right in their own eyes, and our young people are being conditioned to believe that that truth is true for them if they choose to believe it. You see, when you have bad ideas, you end up with bad culture. And when you have the idea that living for the moment and immediate gratification is what you ought to do, then you end up with a culture that is deeply promiscuous and deeply in debt. On the other hand, when you have good ideas, you end up with good culture. And these ideas are often spread by their champions. In the past, that would be the philosophers, the writers, the academics. But today, in our culture, it is more influenced by the entertainers, by the social media influencers, by the YouTubers. In no time in history has society been influenced by entertainers more than ours. By the musicians are the ones that we look up to. By the athletes, the news. But the main influence of any culture is its institutions. The primary institutions of any society are the government, it is religious groups, and it is family, which, by the way, are the three that the Lord sets up in his word. The problem in our country is that the family unit, in a biblical sense, is fading away. churches are diminishing, and the ones that are growing are far from what God wants it to be. That leads the government. And of course, we know what it decides. But these age-old institutions are being replaced with other institutions, like educational institutions and financial institutions that are influential. And as their ideas change, so do our cultures. They influence our culture through academics and marketings, and soon those ideas become the norm. The challenge for us as Christians is not to allow these ideas to affect our thinking and our actions. And the challenge for us as parents is not to allow the culture around us to influence them. And so we protect them from that and we guide them through it. It is a constant battle that we face. You know, Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 3 that we walk according to the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. The war that we have is not really against culture. It's a spiritual battle. It's against Satan himself. The weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but divinely powerful for the destruction of fortresses. We are destroying speculations and every lofty thing raised up against the knowledge of God or God's ideas, God's truth. And we are taking every thought captive in obedience to Christ. I don't think there's any doubt, but that it is increasingly difficult to be a New Testament disciple of Christ. And it may not be getting easier with our children. No longer is it considered respectable in our culture to hold religious views. But I want you to understand that this battle is not new for Christians. If you have your Bibles now, turn to the Bible reading that we read just a moment ago in Hebrews chapter 13. And let me give you a little bit of background into this passage. You know, throughout the book of Hebrews, the Hebrew writer has spent a great deal of time on doctrinal matters. And really the theme, I think, of the book of Hebrews is that Jesus is greater. Why would you want to go back into Judaism when Jesus is so much greater? He is greater than the angels. He's greater than the prophets who came before him. And though he is the Son of God, he is our brother. He is high above the angels. He is deity. And he's greater lawgiver than Moses. He is a greater deliverer than Joshua. He's a greater high priest. We have a greater law, so forth and so on. But as he begins to bring this book to a close, there's some very specific matters of practical Christian living that are given to us in this chapter. And that's because the essence of Christianity is not how many facts we can cram into our heads. The essence of Christianity is how we're to make the things that we learn apply to us day by day, which is how we ought to be teaching our children. And so he comes to chapter 13, and the Hebrew writer talks about some specific practical matters. And he answers the question, what difference does it make that Jesus is greater in our lives? And so in verses 1 through 3, he talks about showing love and hospitality and sympathy. And in verse 4, he mentions the need to keep the marriage bed pure for sexual purity. In verses 5 and 6, he deals with the covetousness, and he talks about the importance of being satisfied and content with what we have. Verses 7 through 9, he encourages these Christians to be steadfast in the faith. But then in verse 10, he begins a passage of importance that I think talks about separation from our culture. Again, let's read verse 10. We have an altar from which those who serve the tabernacle have no right to eat. For the bodies of those animals whose blood is brought into the holy place by the high priest as an offering for sin are burned outside the camp. Therefore, Jesus also, that he might sanctify the people through his own blood, suffered outside the gate. You know, because this was a letter that was written, obviously, to Jewish Christians, the Hebrew writer reminds these Christians of something in their Old Testament past. You need to know that sometimes when an animal was sacrificed to the Jew by a Jew or by an Israelite, that he would bring that and he would eat some of it, obviously, and the priest would eat of some of that. But none of the meat from a sin offering was eaten because the entire animal, according to Leviticus chapter 6 and verse 30, was to be burned up. And the ashes of that sacrifice were then thrown outside the camp. And they were considered unclean, and they were dumped outside the camp, which you can imagine basically became a garbage dump, I guess you might say, outside the camp. Well, the Hebrew writer wants us to see how fitting that was, that Jesus literally was crucified outside of the city of Jerusalem. That he wants us to realize that Christianity didn't begin with a bunch of public acceptance. That Jesus didn't receive any medals recognizing him as the outstanding young teacher of the year. That there was no eternal flame that was burning for Jerusalem, or for Jesus rather, at the Jerusalem National Cemetery. Instead, he was killed on a cross. The Jewish culture in Jerusalem rejected him. And we're reminded that the actual crucifixion took place outside of the walls of Jerusalem. That Jesus was crucified at Golgotha. That is the place of the skull. It was a place outside the realm of acceptance and respectability. That Jesus wasn't crucified in a cathedral between two candles, but instead he was crucified on a cross, a Roman cross, between two thieves. He was killed in a despicable place. It was the kind of place where cynics talk smut and where thieves curse, where soldiers gamble, and where people walk by wagging insults at whoever is hanging there. The cross means a lot of things, but first and foremost, it meant shame and reproach to those people in that day. Jesus was rejected by the establishment. He was rejected by their culture. And the message of the cross was a continuing source of rejection for the early church. Remember, Paul said in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 22, indeed, Jews asked for signs, the Greeks searched for wisdom, the Sophia that he talked about earlier. But we preach Christ crucified, to Jews a stumbling block, and to Gentiles foolishness. It was a stumbling block. And the reason was because everyone knew that good men just don't die on crosses. And so the message of the cross was foolishness to the Jews, and it was a stumbling block it was foolishness to the Greeks, but it was a stumbling block to the Jews. Jesus died outside the camp. And what we must be teaching our children is we must be willing to live outside the camp as well. Look at the very next verse, verse 13. Hence, let us go out to him outside the camp, bearing his reproach. If Jesus died outside the camp of respectability and acceptance, then why would we think that Christians would be spared the experience of sharing this faith? Look at how Jesus put it in John chapter 15. If the world hates you, you know that it has hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world, the world would love its own, but because you're not of the world, you're not of this culture. But I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. Remember the word that I said to you, a slave is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will also persecute you. If they kept my word, they will keep yours also. Jesus said that the attitude of the world towards his apostles would be hatred, because of the fact that they were obviously and radically different from the culture around them. The fact that we follow Jesus, it makes us different. A life of faith has always meant living a life that's different from the culture around you. That was true of the heroes of the faith that he talks about a couple of chapters before this in Hebrews chapter 11. When you think about it, Joseph wasn't a great man because he adopted the morals around him that everyone else had in Egypt. No, he stood out. And Daniel wasn't a great man because he made sure he ate the same things that everyone else was eating so he could fit in. The Hebrew writer says that our faith takes us outside the camp in a culture where Christianity seems absurd to most people. The striking thing, though, about the statement that is made here in verse 13 is the reminder that our legitimate place as Christians is outside the camp. And as parents, we need to understand the importance of this message. In fact, passing the torch of Christianity on to the next generation will not happen unless we understand this message. Parents, it's essential that we come to see ourselves as outside the camp of culture. And it's essential that we teach our children that. And they must be taught that in doing so, we're going to be seen as different from the world around us, sometimes radically different. And I'm not talking about here isolating ourselves from the world. There's a temptation to want to do that, isn't there? There's a temptation to want to just be around Christians, or maybe just around your own individual family. You know, that's what the medieval monks tried to do. They thought that if they could just isolate themselves from this wicked people around them, that they would be isolated from sin as well. And so they built a wall, and they put sinners on the outside, and they kept themselves on the inside. You know what the problem is? That didn't separate them from sin. Their hearts weren't changed. And as adults, we can't do that either. We are to be salt, and we are to be light to the world. Jesus said, "You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt has become tasteless, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except for to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men." We are what makes this world palatable. But then he goes on to say, "You're the light of the world, a city that is set on the hill. Our influence is there. Nor does anyone light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand and gives all a light to all who are in the house. Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may glorify, that they may see your good works, and that they may glorify your Father who is in heaven." Jesus stressed the need for us to be an influence of salt and light on the world around us. But to a full extent, I want you to understand, that's not the role of our youngest children yet. Jesus wasn't talking necessarily to children in this passage. They first had to be protected. They had to be molded and then slowly released into the world to be salt and light. But they don't start out that way. You've probably heard the analogy of a tomato plant before, that you may start it this time of year inside your house. You're starting the seed and it's starting to grow. But when it's finally time to transplant that, you just don't take it out one day and plant it in the ground. Otherwise, it will die. You slowly adapt it to its environment, and then it can grow and be strong. And that's what we're doing with our children as well. Our ultimate goal is to shoot them out as arrows into this world. Psalm 127 says in verse 4, "Like arrows in the hand of a warrior, so are the children of one's youth. How blessed is the man whose quiver is full of them. They will not be ashamed when they speak with their enemies in the gate." Arrows aren't in the quiver just to stay in the quiver. They're meant to fly. Our children are meant to eventually impact the world around us in the right way. There are many practice releases, however, before they are ready. You know, just as an archer who's preparing, he's learning, he might first go out there and try the bow out, and he stretches it, and he learns how to put that up to his cheek the way he's supposed to. Then he may get an arrow, and he puts it in there, and he places it, but he still doesn't shoot it. But then, of course, he puts the practice tip on it, and he goes out to the target, and he tries it, and releases a little short way so he can retrieve that arrow. But then there's that one day that he goes out, he puts a real arrowhead on it, and he hunts for the deer, and he releases that into the air, and it has its influence. There are many practice releases for our children as well. Cutting the umbilical cord is one short release. Weaning our child, baby stages of food, sleeping in their own bed, staying with someone that we trust for just a little while, going to camp, getting their driver's license, then going off to college. You see, it's all a process. It's all practice releases. But the goal is to teach them to be as we are to a culture. And that is, we're teaching them to be salt and light now so they can go out and be salt and light to our culture. And part of the biblical training of our children is that they must be able to live in this world but not be a part of this world. In 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 9, as he's speaking about church discipline there, he says, "I wrote to you my letter not to associate with immoral people. I didn't mean with the immoral people of this world or our culture around us, or with the covetous or swindlers or idolaters, for then you would have to go out of this world." And Paul implies here that would be impossible. You're supposed to live among these people. That's just the way that it is. But you can't be like them. Jesus said, as he prayed to the Father, "I do not ask that you take them out of the world, but that you keep them from the evil one," that is Satan, who is behind the culture. I'm not talking about removing ourselves and our family completely from society. But what I am warning about here is the problem that develops when we begin to adopt the same goals as the culture around us. When we're immersed in the things of this world, when we start to talk like they talk, when we start to dress like they dress, when we start to have the same priorities that they do, when we start to watch the same movies that they watch, when we start to listen to the same music that they listen to, then what happens is we become totally indistinguishable from the rest of the world, and they are not salt and they are not light. We're no longer different because we become comfortable inside the camp. We have to realize that Christ calls us to take on a set of standards that appear to the world to be foolish. As Scott talked about this morning in Romans chapter 12 and verse 2, we can't be conformed to this world, but we must be transformed. How? By the renewing of your mind. There's that idea of ideas, that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. Or to put it another way, don't let the world squeeze your children into its mold. There's a word in the Bible that it uses to sum up, I think, what we're talking about here today, and it's the word sanctification. The word sanctification or sanctify literally means to be set apart. The noun form of that Greek word, by the way, is those who have been set apart, and it's usually translated as saints. That's what we are. We are set apart from this world. Those of us who are Christians, we're to be sanctified, set apart. And to do that, we have to be different. The temple was a sanctified building because it was different from any other building around it. The Sabbath day was a sanctified, holy day because it was different from the other 6 days of the week. And Christians are to be sanctified people because we are different from the culture around us. We need to constantly teach our children that we are different because we follow Jesus. We're different because we're governed by a different standard, a standard of right and wrong. We're different because we believe in an absolute truth that dictates how we must live, that we have a different set of ideas that's not our own, but it is God's. They need to realize the truth that many times the world around us simply won't understand or appreciate the things that mean so much to us. And what that means is sometimes we're going to seem out of touch with the rest of the world. That's one of the reasons that we need our times together. I want to show you the results of an experiment that I heard about one time and I read about. You know, thinking about stereotypes, and I certainly don't want this to be racist at all. I don't want you to think that way at all. That's not the purpose of this. But just how we think in stereotypes. Who is better at math? Men or women? Okay, don't answer out loud, please, especially if you're sitting next to someone of an opposite gender. But who do we usually think of when we think of as being better than math? Men or women? Now, usually we think of men being better at math. Now, generally, we understand there are some women who are better at math than men. But now, then again, as we're talking about math, which race is considered to be better at math? And I think usually when we think about that, we think of Asians. That's usually what we think of. And so scientists wanted to know, how well do Asian women perform on math tests? Which is interesting. If prior to the test, they put an emphasis on the fact that they were a woman. They said, you know, you're going to take this test, but we know you're a woman, but just try the best that you can. I didn't say that, by the way. They didn't do as well. But if they were presented with the test and they said, we know that you're Asian, and so you're going to do great on this, they actually did. The test scores were actually better in that particular situation. And the psychological term for that is called a stereotype threat, which simply means that we tend to perform on a level based upon what's expected of us. So what does that have to do with us as Christians? Well, quite a bit, actually. That we are children of God who live among the culture around us. And daily there is given to us a spiritual test in holiness and in sanctification. And if we're constantly reminded about the fact that we are a part of this culture, then we're going to tend to do pretty badly on the spiritual test. But if we're reminded of the fact that we are children of God, then we are going to do well on that. That's what we have to keep at the forefront of our minds and in our children's mind. We are children of God living among this culture, and we are going to succeed. We are constantly being reminded, and we need to remind our children, that they are God's children, that they are strangers and aliens in this foreign world, and that they are we need a constant reminder of who they are and whose they are. Almost every time that our children leave the home, Alina will say that to them. Remember who you are and whose you are. She says, keep Jesus on the throne. Whenever she is hanging up on the phone with them, talking to that, it is a reminder of who they belong to in this world. We need to be reminded that we live outside the camp. I want to share with you one last verse, and that is verse 14, where he says, beginning in verse 14, for here we do not have a lasting city, but we are seeking the city which is to come. The Hebrew writer here reminds us of the reason why we're to be different, why we are to live outside the camp, why we're willing to be looked down upon by our culture around us, because we're seeking a city which is to come. There's a reward, a goal at the end of the journey. We have to go outside the camp. Because like Abraham before us, we are searching with a city whose foundations and whose architect and builder is God. That we don't live inside that city now, but we are looking for a different kind of city. You know, before Alina and I will take any trip, we have to consider whether it is worth it or not to take that trip. And we've been known to go as many miles as 2,000 miles in 1 week. Seeing old friends, visiting our children, visiting with family, going to see family members or friends graduate or getting married or whatever. All of those things make it worth it. But if we were driving that far merely to see the world's largest boot in Minnesota, and that really is a thing, then you can bet that I would turn around right away. In fact, I wouldn't even start that journey. And if there's not something at the end that makes it all worthwhile, you're going to quit traveling. And that's what the Hebrew writer, I think, is saying here. No, it's not easy to live among this culture. Sometimes it gets very tiring to live counterculturally. And it is very tiring to raise countercultural thinking children. But there's something at the end of our journey that makes the journey worthwhile for us and for our children. But the only way they can get there is to be willing to follow Jesus outside the camp. And to do so is to mark themselves as being different. We have to teach them to subject themselves to the reproach of the culture around us. You know, as Christians, we must be willing to leave the camp of our culture. And that doesn't mean that we have to become Amish. That doesn't mean we have to live in monasteries. It doesn't even mean that you have to give up your cell phones. But it does mean that you got to be willing to give up the ideas that are driving the culture around us, that we sometimes just accept as normal, but in fact are at odds with God's word. If you're not a Christian this morning, we invite you to become one. And in extending that invitation, we're not simply asking you to agree with a certain proposition or accept a certain doctrine. What we're inviting you to do is to follow Jesus outside the camp. We're inviting you to accept his values, his ideals, and to leave those of society behind. And in so doing, you will run the risk of incurring ridicule and scorn in our society around us. But that's okay, because you'll be on your way to a heavenly city, a lasting city, a city where God is. And in the end, that's all that matters. Or perhaps you're a Christian who in the past has traveled outside the camp to be with Jesus, but you've returned to the camp because you'd rather be like others around you. You like the things that the world entices, and you don't want to bear the shame, maybe, that comes with following after Jesus. God has not called us to live in the respectability of the world. And so this morning I challenge you all to live outside the camp. We invite you to be willing to bear the disgrace of the one who bore disgrace for you, and to teach that to your children as well. If we can assist you in any way, we encourage you to come forward now as we stand and as we sing.